to recall that Harvard was the president's alma mater, and that it was at Harvard, on an occasion similar to that of this morning, I first had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Roosevelt and of forming a friendship which in years to come was not to be without its associations with the public life of our respective countries. May I turn now to the particular ceremony of this afternoon and its significance. There is always a satisfaction in seeing the completion of an important public undertaking. I should like to join with others present in extending heartiest congratulations to all who have had to do with the conception, construction, and completion of the Thousand Islands International Bridge. In May of last year, while attending in London the coronation of their Majesties King George and Queen Elizabeth, I had the honor of being invited to open a new bridge over the Thames at Chelsea. My thoughts at the time were naturally of that historic river whose rural beauty is a pleasure to all and upon whose banks are famous cities, including Oxford and London. I did not forget that the waters of the Thames had witnessed great struggles for freedom, which had brought the British race to a proud position in the world. Nor did I forget that these associations formed a part of the heritage of the British Commonwealth. All of this comes back to my mind as I seek to speak of the significance of today's ceremony. It is not the Thames, it is the St. Lawrence that is in our thoughts today. The St. Lawrence, too, is not without its history, a history which may well be the pride of the peoples of this continent. It also has its great natural beauty. Where in the whole wide world is there a more majestic approach to the interior of any land, more in the way of a never-changing loveliness on an unprecedented scale? The St. Lawrence, too, has witnessed cities, universities, and capitals rise into being on its banks. Its waters, like those of the Thames, have been the scene of many struggles which have contributed to a larger freedom. So much for similarities, which are not without their significance. There are differences, however, which are of even greater significance to the world today. The Thames, from its source to the sea, is within the confines of a single state. Its waters are national in character. The waters of the St. Lawrence, in considerable part, are international waters. They serve to divide as well as to unite. The possibilities of friction between the two countries are not lessened by the fact that their boundary in part is a vast inland waterway which stretches 1,000 and more miles from the interior of the continent to the sea. Over the greater part of that distance, rivers and lakes constitute the international frontier between Canada and the United States. The bridge at Chelsea serves to emphasize and enhance the inheritance of commerce and culture shared by those who dwell on either bank of the Thames, a single people in one country. This Thousand Islands Bridge serves to emphasize, and we cannot doubt will enhance through the years, the inheritance of commerce and culture shared by the peoples on either bank of the St. Lawrence. Not one people, but two. The bridge at Chelsea stands as a symbol of national unity. This bridge is a symbol of international amity. It constitutes yet another of the many bonds which join two peoples who rival one another, not in enmities or in armaments, but in devotion to the ways of peace and the spirit of conciliation. Upon a bridge itself a symbol of international friendship and goodwill, we are celebrating once again a century and more of peace between the United States and Canada. When we reflect upon the disputed frontiers which threaten peace in other quarters of the globe, we cannot but feel that the ceremony in which we are participating has in it something of significance to the world. It may be thought that we owe our achievement to a common background, or that it is due to chance that our frontiers differ so greatly from the frontiers of states on other continents. It is true, we can claim to share the culture of two old world civilizations. The names of Champlain and Frontenac, Marquette and LaSalle, belong scarcely less to you than to us. And no historian has recounted their exploits more vividly than your own Francis Parkman. Likewise, until 1776, the history and heritage of the British Commonwealth, to which I referred a moment ago, belonged as much to the 13 colonies as it does to us. This common background, however, was not sufficient to ensure our peace. The Seven Years' War, the War of the American Revolution, the War of 1812, the Canadian Rebellion of 1837-38, all turned the St. Lawrence and the Great Lakes into an area of significant conflict. The ancestors of those who today are here assembled to rejoice that another link has been forged which serves to further their common interests and to cement their friendship, were in those turbulent periods of our history at enmity one with the other in either civil or international strife. Human nature is much the same wherever it exists. Our populations, after all, do not in origin differ greatly from those of Europe. Indeed, the European countries have contributed most to their composition. Each of our countries has its problems of race and creed and class. Each has its full measure of political controversy. Nevertheless, we seem to have found the better way to secure and maintain our peace. This international highway speaks of that better way. In itself, it is one vast undertaking, but it is made up of pieces of solid ground and a series of bridges. Where solid ground has been lacking and the way in consequence made impassable, bridges have been built. Imposing structures they are, ingeniously combining utility and beauty. In the realm of international relations, we too have learned to bridge our differences. We have practiced the art of building bridges. There is indeed no more striking symbol of unity, of intercourse, and of friendship than a bridge. From antiquity to the present, bridges have been built to span the spaces of separation. Their very appearance suggests the surmounting of difficulties, the overcoming of barriers, the broadening of the path of progress and peace. The peoples of this continent, whether concerned with steel and stone, or with the invisible realities of mind and spirit, have, for the most part, been bridge builders worthy of the name. In politics, as in road making, it is a great thing, Mr. President, to know how to build bridges. In the art of international bridge building, there are two structures, each with its association with the St. Lawrence and the Great Lakes, of which I should like to say just a word. They stand out as monuments of international cooperation and goodwill. Each has its message for the world of today. The one is the Rushbaggett Agreement, already referred to so eloquently by Mr. Bray, the Lieutenant Governor of New York. The other, the International Joint Commission, created in 1909. Before the War of 1812, and while it was being waged, citadels and arsenals came into being. Naval yards were set up, and armed craft appeared on the waters of the St. Lawrence and the lakes. Hostile ports rounded each other from opposite shores. An armament race had begun, and had it been permitted to continue, we should have been looking back on a century of suspicion, enmity, and hatred, instead of rejoicing as we are in a century and more of peace. In the course of the War of 1812, as many as 20 armed vessels were constructed in the naval yards at Kingston. One of these, the St. Lawrence, was actually larger in size and carried more guns than Nelson's Victory at the Battle of Trafalgar. Within 3 years of the conclusion of the war, we happily had determined to place our reliance upon reason instead of upon force, and to substitute for any surviving ill will such a measure of solid goodwill as should bridge succeeding years. As Mr. Bray has already told you, by the Rush-Bagot Agreement, the total armament on the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence, as well as Lake Champlain, was not to exceed 6 armed vessels weighing not more than 100 tons and mounting 1 18-pounder apiece. On the first of this month, I had the honor of reopening at Kingston the large fort which has recently been restored. Its name is Fort Henry. It, too, owed much of its size and strength to the War of 1812 and to fears of possible future invasion of Canada by her powerful neighbor. Fort Henry has been reconstructed to attract, not to repel, possible invasions from the United States. The Rush-Bagot Agreement was a self-denying ordinance. As such, it provided a means of escape from competitive arming. It was limited in its application to the St. Lawrence and the Lakes. In fact, it served to end all armaments on an international frontier extending from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific. This significant document has served as the most effective instrument in promoting between our neighboring countries an enduring peace. The decision never to arm against each other was taken, as I have indicated, over a century ago. In our time, we have crowned that decision by the construction of other bridges of international friendship and understanding. By far the most important of them is the International Joint Commission. It was created to adjudicate all questions of difference arising along our 4,000 miles of frontier. In the quarter of a century of its existence, by substituting investigation for dictation and conciliation for coercion in the adjustment of international disputes, the Commission has solved many questions likely to lead to serious controversy. This bridge has been the more significant in that while countries on the continents of Europe and Asia have been increasing their frontier armaments, the United States and Canada have settled all their boundary differences by the method and processes of reasoned discussion. A word in conclusion. The international bridge of which I have been speaking, and of which our international bridges are fitting symbols, has grown naturally out of our common needs and our common will to live together as good friends and neighbors. All stand as acts of faith in human intelligence. They mean for us a precious cultural and constitutional heritage, which it is our joint purpose to foster and maintain. It will be at once obvious that the challenges to an international order founded upon the rule of law are many and dangerous. No one who looks at the distracted and disordered state of the world today can fail to be impressed by the extent the forces of international anarchy are seeking to prevail and to subvert those standards of human conduct which we have come to regard as essential attributes. I think I speak the mind of both countries when I say that not only are we determined to preserve the neighborly relations and the free ways of life, which are our priceless heritage, but that we earnestly wish to see them become a part of the common heritage of mankind. To that end, we are prepared to go on building bridges, to throw the span of friendship and of freedom across the troubled waters of our time. Among the officials of the state of New York, whom we are happy to have with us today, is the Comptroller, a man who has served the state in that capacity for many years. He has long been interested in Canadian and American relations, and in fact attended the College of Upper Canada at Toronto. Not only has he been an able administrator, but during the course of his public service, he has evidenced continually his interest in the public welfare of this great state and in important projects that are for the betterment of the state. I have the honor to present the Honorable Morris S. Tremaine of Buffalo, the Comptroller of the State of New York.
Mr. Chairman, Your Excellency the President, Your Excellency the Governor General, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, as Comptroller of the State of New York and acting on behalf of its people, I am happy to have played a part in the construction of these bridges that bind together two traditionally friendly nations. We purchased a large part of these bonds for this project for the people of the state, not only in the belief that they were a good investment, but also in order to further the spirit of friendly cooperation between Canada and the United States. While some nations in other parts of the world are building bristling barriers to separate their peoples, the structures we are dedicating today constitute a physical embodiment of the good neighbor spirit, which has become the settled policy of our country. We are extremely fortunate in having at this international gathering the author, the living symbol of that spirit. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
And you, thousands of you, who are here today representing millions of other bridge builders on both sides of the international line. It has always seemed to me that the best symbol of common sense was a bridge. Common sense is sometimes slow in getting into action. And perhaps that is why we took so long to build this one. It is a particular pleasure to me to meet you here, where a boundary is a gateway and not a wall. Between these islands, an international gap never wide has been spanned, as gaps usually are, by the exercise of ability, guided by cooperative common sense. I hope that all my countrymen will use it freely, and I know that they will find, as I have done today and on many other occasions, a happy welcome on the Canadian shore and a forthright fellowship with neighbors who are also friends. The St. Lawrence River is more than a cartographic line between our two countries. God so formed North America that the waters of an inland empire drain into the Great Lakes Basin. The rain that falls in that vast area finds outlet through this single natural funnel, close to which we now stand. Events of history have made that river a boundary, and as a result, the flow of these waters can be used only by joint agreement between our two governments. Between us, therefore, we stand as trustees for two countries, trustees for one of the richest natural assets provided anywhere in the world. The water that runs underneath this bridge spells unlimited power, permits access to raw materials both from this continent and from beyond the seas, and enhances commerce and production. When a resource of that kind is placed at our very doors, I think the plain people of both countries agree that it is ordinary common sense to make a use of it. And yet up the liquid wealth which flowing water is has run in large part unused to the sea. I really think that this situation suggests that we can agree upon some better arrangement than merely letting this water contribute a microscopic fraction to the level of the Atlantic Ocean. The bridge which we here dedicate is a tangible proof that administration by two neighbors of a job to be done in common offers no difficulty. Obviously, the same process applied on a larger scale to the resource of full seagoing navigation and of complete power development offered by the St. Lawrence River can build and maintain the necessary facilities to employ its magnificent possibilities. I suppose it is true, as it has been true of all natural resources, that a good many people, quite naturally, like the resources themselves, would like to have a job and the profits of developing it by themselves and for themselves. In this case, however, the river happens to be placed in the hands of our two governments, and the responsibility, the trusteeship for getting the results lies plainly at our doors. At various times, both the people of Canada and the people of the United States have dreamed of the St. Lawrence and Great Lakes development. They have translated those ideas into plans. Plans, incidentally, that with modern engineering skill can be easily and readily carried out. While there has been no difference between us as to the objective sort, history compels me to say that we have not been able to arrange matters so that both peoples have had the same idea at the same time. I offer a suggestion. How would it do for a change if instead of each of us having the idea at alternate intervals, we should get the idea simultaneously? And I am very much inclined to believe that we are rapidly approaching that happy and desirable event. There are many prophets of evil, There always have been before anything was done. I am very clear, for example, that prophets of trouble are wrong when they express the fear that the St. Lawrence waterway will handicap our railway system on both sides of the border. We know now that the effect of a waterway in most cases is not to take traffic away from railroad lines. Actually, it creates new possibilities, new business, and new activity. Such a waterway generates more railroad traffic than it takes away. There is, as we know, there is today a 14-foot channel carrying traffic from the Great Lakes through the St. Lawrence River into the Atlantic Ocean. If this channel were improved and deepened, which again can be easily done, deepened to 27 or 30 feet, every city in both nations on the Great Lakes and on the whole course of navigation from the sea to the head of the lakes, every city would become an ocean port. The banks of the St. Lawrence itself, the whole of the St. Lawrence Valley, would become one of the great gateways of the world and would benefit accordingly. Here, all that is needed is cooperative exercise of technical skill by joint use of the imagination and the vision, which we know both our countries have. Can anyone doubt that when this is done, the interests of both countries will be greatly advanced? Do we need to delay? Do we need to deprive our peoples of the immediate employment and profit, or prevent our generation from reaping the harvest that awaits us? Now, my friends, let me make an unusual statement. I am sure that on neither side of the line will you misunderstand me. I consider that I have myself a particular interest in the St. Lawrence, an interest dating back to my earliest days in the legislature of the state of New York in 1911, and I have a particular duty as president in connection with the development of the St. Lawrence, both for navigation and power. The almost unparalleled opportunity which the river affords has not gone unnoticed by some of my friends on the American side of the border. A conception has been emerging in the United States which is not without a certain magnificence. This is no less than the conviction that if a private group could control the outlet of the Great Lakes Basin on both sides of the border, that group would have a monopoly in the development of a territory larger than many of the great empires in history. If you were to search the records with which my government is familiar, you would discover that literally every development of electric power, save only the Ontario Hydro, is allied to, if not controlled, by a single American group. With, of course, the usual surrounding penumbra of allies, affiliates, subsidiaries, and satellites. In earlier stages of development of natural resources on this continent, this was normal and usual. But in recent decades, we have come to realize the implications to the public, to the individual men and women, to businessmen, big and little, and even to government itself, resulting from the ownership by any group of the right to dispose of wealth, which was granted to us collectively by nature herself. The development of natural resources and the proper handling of their fruits is a major problem of government. Naturally, no solution would be acceptable to either nation, which does not leave its government entirely master in its own house. To put it bluntly, a group of American interests is here gradually putting itself into a position where, unless caution is exercised, they may in time be able to determine the economic and the social fate of a large area, both in Canada and in the United States. Now, it is axiomatic in Canadian-American relations that both of us scrupulously respect the right of each of us to determine our own internal affairs. For that reason, when I know that the operation of uncontrolled American economic forces is slowly producing a result on the Canadian side of the border, which I know very well must eventually give American groups a great influence over Canadian development, I consider it the part of a good neighbor to express my opinion out loud, to discuss the question frankly with my Canadian neighbors. Yes, the least I can do is to call attention to the situation as I see it. Our mutual friendship suggests this course in a matter of development as great and as crucial as that of the St. Lawrence River and the basin tributary to it. Fortunately, among friendly nations today, this is increasingly being done. Frank discussion between friends and neighbors is useful and essential. It is obvious today that some economic problems are international, if only because of the sheer weight which the solutions have on the lives of people outside as well as inside of any one country. To my mind, the development of St. Lawrence navigation and power is such a problem. I look forward to the day when a Canadian Prime Minister and an American President can meet to dedicate not a bridge across this water, but the very water itself to the lasting and productive use of their respective peoples. And until that day comes, and I hope that it may be soon, this bridge, the Thousand Islands, this garden spot of nature, this bridge stands as an open door. There will be no challenge at the border. There will be no guard to ask a countersign. Where the boundary is crossed, the only word must be pass, friend.
You have been listening to the dedication ceremonies of the Thousand Islands International Bridge at Ivy Lee, across the border from Collins Landing, New York. The bridge was dedicated by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Mr. Mackenzie King, Prime Minister of Canada. We appreciate the courtesy of the makers of concentrated super suds, sponsors of Mert and Marge, usually heard at this period over some of these stations, for relinquishing their time today in order that we might present the special program just concluded.